You're walking down the streets of central Moscow, and what do you see? These monumental buildings, huge, imposing, and full of grandeur. Brick and cinder blocks, ornate details that scream power and prestige. These structures feel like they're built for the elite, for those at the top. But take a few steps further out, beyond the Garden Ring, and everything changes. What you see now are these endless rows of towering apartment blocks. They shoot up to the sky, some as high as 16 floors. Gone are the fancy details and brickwork. Instead, it's just cold, hard concrete, stark, uniform, and uninviting. These are the defining remnants of the Soviet era. And if you've ever pictured the former USSR in your mind, this is probably what you imagine. Now push even further out, past the Third Ring, and the scene shifts again. The buildings shrink, no higher than 5 stories. Some are barely hanging on, crumbling, while others have been given a fresh coat of paint, trying to stay relevant. Some are being torn down entirely, abandoned to time. Each of these architectural shifts tells a story about the Soviet Union's leaders, their vision for housing, and the changing needs of the country. In this video, we're going to break down how housing worked under the USSR, how urban planning reflected different eras, how social class influenced where you lived, and most importantly, how regular people navigated the complex bureaucratic process of finding a home in a system built on uncertainty. This is How Soviet Housing Worked. Alright, let's take a step back to 1917. Russia is in chaos, impoverished, underdeveloped, and barely beginning to industrialize, while the rest of Europe has surged ahead. Cities were flooded with people looking for work, but the Tsarist government wasn't prepared. Living conditions were terrible. Overcrowded slums, no running water or electricity, life was harsh. And to top it off, Russia was dragged into a series of wars that devastated the country, leading to food shortages and widespread discontent. In 1917, people had enough. After years of suffering, the Tsar stepped down and a new provisional government took over. But they didn't solve anything. The war dragged on, food became even scarcer, and social unrest exploded. That's when the Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, stepped in with a radical promise: communism. In October 1917, the Bolsheviks overthrew the provisional government, and after a brutal 6-year civil war, they emerged victorious. By 1923, Lenin had created the world's first communist state, the Soviet Union. So, what does all of this have to do with housing? Under communism, private property didn't exist. The state would own everything, including housing, and distribute it according to need. The idea? Everyone shares, no one goes without. Lenin got straight to work on housing reform. Private homes were seized, and landowners, their properties were confiscated and handed over to the people. But here's the thing, this was uncharted territory. No one had ever tried communism on this scale before, so a lot of the reforms were experimental, and that included housing. Lenin had a big idea. Instead of everyone having their own home, people should live collectively. Apartments were divided up into smaller units, with families sharing kitchens, bathrooms, and hallways. These were called communal apartments. Now, picture this. You used to own a big, luxurious home. Suddenly, it's chopped up into small rooms, and you're stuck living in one of those rooms, sharing everything with other families. It was an ideal, crowded, uncomfortable, but for most people, it was still an upgrade from the shacks or barracks they had been living in. But communal apartments weren't enough. As more people flooded into cities, the government started building dormitory-style housing for workers and students. These massive structures were built in a style called constructivism. No frills, no decoration, just functional industrial buildings designed to reflect the new Soviet society. Inside, the setup was similar: minimal personal space, shared kitchens, bathrooms, and dining areas. These buildings were managed by housing committees, small bureaucratic bodies responsible for making sure everything ran smoothly. They enforced state rules, settled disputes, and even collected rent. Yes, rent. Even though housing was a right, it wasn't free. Rent was low, just enough to cover basic maintenance, but you still had to pay. Utilities were also subsidized, although things like heating were centrally controlled, turned on and off by local authorities depending on the season. All in all, housing costs were incredibly affordable, usually only about 3-6% of a household's income. But that didn't mean life in these communal apartments was easy. Overcrowding was a constant issue. Multi-generational families often shared a single room, and privacy was non-existent. non-existent. Tensions between families, especially when one of them had been the original owner of the property, were incredibly common. And this was just the beginning. As the Soviet Union evolved, so did its housing system, changing with each leader and reshaping the way people lived for decades to come. In theory, Soviet housing was supposed to be the ultimate equalizer, everyone living together, sharing resources in a classless society. But in reality, Stalin's Soviet Union created an entirely new kind of social hierarchy, and housing became one of its clearest markers. When Joseph Stalin took over after Lenin's death in 1924, his main goal wasn't housing, it was industrialization. He wanted to transform the Soviet Union into a global superpower, proving that communism was the superior economic system. Housing, though important, was secondary, but Stalin still had his own vision for how Soviet homes should look. Stalin rejected the minimalist, bare-bones constructivism that had dominated the 1920s. He thought it was too radical, too ugly, and didn't reflect Soviet pride. Instead, he wanted buildings that looked powerful, grand, something that would project strength, not just to the Soviet people, but to the entire world. This gave rise to the Stalinka, monumental neoclassical buildings that oozed strength and pride. They weren't just homes, they were symbols of Soviet ambition, often adorned with socialist icons and revolutionary art to reinforce the idea of a united, powerful nation. Stalinka apartments were a massive upgrade from the cramped communal flats of the Lenin era. These were designed for single families with high ceilings, large windows, and spacious kitchens. For many, it must have felt like they'd finally made it, a real home with privacy, comfort, and even elevators in buildings with more than 5 floors. But here's the catch. These apartments were built using bricks and cinder blocks, which made them slow and expensive to construct. Stalin could never build enough to house the rapidly growing urban population, and that's where the new class system kicked in. Housing wasn't about equality under Stalin, it was about loyalty. The best apartments, those in the coveted Stalinkas, were reserved for the Soviet elite, party officials, top military commanders, and the intellectual elite. If you were a doctor, engineer, or scientist, you might get lucky and land a Stalinka, but it wasn't guaranteed. And if you were an unskilled worker, good luck. Most manual laborers were stuck in overcrowded communal apartments, or at best, a bare-bones version of a Stalinka. No frills, no luxury, just function over form. And then there was World War II. Housing development went to a screeching halt. The Soviet Union funneled everything it had into the war effort. By 1950, the housing shortage was catastrophic. Imagine entire families crammed into single rooms, every inch of space packed with beds, belongings, people. Privacy was gone. By this point, most urban residents had less than 5 square meters of living space per person. For most Soviet citizens, it wasn't just about cramped spaces, it was about survival. The housing crisis felt endless, and as Stalin poured resources into industrialization and war, people were left waiting, crammed into apartments, with little hope that their situation would improve. When Stalin died in 1953, he left behind a Soviet Union that had achieved massive industrial growth, but the housing system was in shambles. There had never been a unified plan, just a chaotic mess of overcrowded communal apartments and sharp class disparities that went against the very ideals the Soviet Union was supposed to stand for. But Stalin's death brought about the potential for change. The country's new leadership would be forced to confront the housing disaster he left behind, and their solutions would shape the Soviet Union for the next generation. So it's 1953, Stalin is dead. Enter Nikita Khrushchev, a man with big promises and even bigger challenges. One of his most ambitious pledges? To give every family their own apartment. No more cramped communal housing. Now, Khrushchev wasn't a fan of the old Stalinka apartments. Sure, they were grand, but they were slow to build, inefficient, and most importantly, they reflected the class-based system Khrushchev wanted to move away from. So in 1955, he signed a decree on removing excesses from design and construction. That marked the end of the Stalinkas and the beginning of a new era of Soviet housing, one that would come to define the entire Soviet landscape, the Khrushchevka. These apartments were nothing like the lavish Stalinkas. They were bare bones, practical, and, well, ugly. But that was the point. Khrushchev wasn't aiming for beauty, he was aiming for speed, affordability, and uniformity. His goal was simple, get as many people into their own homes as quickly as possible. Now you might wonder, how could a country that was just recently ravaged by World War II afford to build so many apartments? Well, thanks to Stalin's heavy focus on industrialization, the USSR was now an industrial powerhouse, and Khrushchev was about to use it in a way no one had ever seen before. Imagine how cars are made. Parts are manufactured in a factory, then assembled into identical models one after the other. Now picture doing that before apartment buildings. That's the Khrushchevka. Prefabricated concrete panels were mass-produced in factories across the Soviet Union, trucked to construction sites, and quickly assembled like puzzle pieces. This method was so efficient that some Khrushchevkas could be put up in just 2 weeks, and the scale was massive. At its peak, they were building 2.2 million units every year. But with this speed came standardization. Every apartment followed the same blueprint. A one-room apartment was 30 square meters, a two-room, 44 square meters, and a three-room was 60 square meters. They weren't spacious, but they had all the essentials. Central heating, a working sewage system, and a shower. Luxuries for so many Soviets at the time. And it didn't stop at just the apartments. Khrushchev's vision for Soviet housing extended to urban planning. This is where things get really interesting. The Soviet government wasn't just throwing up apartment blocks randomly. They meticulously designed residential districts that housed anywhere from 10,000 to 30,000 people. Each district was divided into smaller micro-districts that held between 8,000 to 12,000 people, with each micro-district being essentially self-contained. You had your schools, shops, parks, post offices, everything you'd need for daily life right within walking distance. You could live your entire life without ever leaving your neighborhood. It was an attempt to build a sense of community while also keeping daily necessities convenient. If you needed something more specialized, like a hospital, that was still within your district and easily accessible by the Soviet public transport system, which was also a key part of this urban plan. This was Khrushchev's way of creating not just homes, but functional connected communities, a kind of social experiment in community living, where you were part of a collective, but with just enough privacy. Now, let's be honest, the Khrushchevkas weren't exactly pretty. Rows and rows of drab, rectangular blocks, all identical. But here's the thing, people were grateful. Imagine living in a cramped communal room, sharing your space with multiple families, and suddenly being handed the keys to your very own apartment, with your own bathroom, kitchen, and bedroom. The aesthetic didn't matter. People were just thrilled to have a place to call home, and after years of sharing, it felt like freedom. But despite the improvements, the housing system wasn't perfect, and it certainly didn't achieve that classless society Khrushchev dreamed of. Even with the new apartments, corruption and bribery were still rampant. Those with political connections or higher-ranking jobs could skip the long waiting lists and move into their new Khrushchevkas faster, leaving many lower-ranked workers stuck in the same old communal apartments for years. Still, Khrushchev's housing policies were incredibly effective. In the first 20 years, they managed to house 60 million people, but there were unintended consequences. As family compositions changed through marriage, divorce, or having more kids, housing demands shifted. But because apartments were assigned based on family size, anyone needing a new, larger space had to go through the waiting list all over again. This led to overcrowding, newlyweds living with their parents, and even divorced couples forced to cohabit, waiting years for new apartments. There was one workaround though. Housing exchanges. Instead of waiting, people could legally swap apartments with others. It was a common practice in the Soviet Union. There were entire sections of newspapers dedicated to these exchanges, with people listing the details of their apartment and what kind of exchange they were looking for. Of course, this process was riddled with bureaucracy and paperwork, but for many, it was faster than waiting for the state to assign a new place. You just needed to find someone willing to trade their apartment for yours and navigate the red tape. By 1964, Khrushchev's time was up. He was ousted by Leonid Brezhnev. But by then, his housing policy had changed the face of the Soviet Union. The Khrushchevka may not have been glamorous, but it provided millions of families with a place to call home. And while the design might have been utilitarian, these buildings still stand today, remnants of a bold, if imperfect, social experiment. By the time Brezhnev came to power in 1964, the Soviet Union was no longer in survival mode. The post-war struggles had eased, and the housing shortage, well, Khrushchev's mass production of those prefabricated cookie-cutter Khrushchevkas had taken care of a lot of that. But now things were different. The economy had stabilized, and with it came more breathing room, literally. Enter the Brezhnevka. So here's the thing, up until now, every Khrushchevka was the same. Same boxy design, same cramped rooms, and the same dull grey concrete, whether you were living in the freezing winters of Siberia or the balmy seaside climate of Crimea. It didn't matter. Same design, same problems. Brezhnevkas changed all that. These buildings weren't just carbon copies anymore. They varied based on the region, adjusting to different climate zones to provide a bit more comfort for people. And it wasn't just about the climate, it was about an upgrade. Think of the Brezhnevka as version 2.0 of Soviet housing. They were still using the prefabricated panels, but now there was room to grow, literally. With a better budget, they could afford elevators. This meant high-rises. They started building taller than 5 floors, packing more people into the same amount of land, in an ever-urbanizing Soviet Union that's huge. And the apartments themselves, they were definitely an improvement. Bigger living spaces, actual corridors instead of those cramped passage rooms, and finally, separate rooms. Khrushchevkas were notorious for having rooms you had to walk through just to get to the next one. With Brezhnevkas, you got a layout that felt more like an actual apartment. The buildings themselves got a bit of a facelift too. Instead of that monotonous grey, some Brezhnevkas came in different colours, and they started mixing in brick or other materials to break up the visual uniformity. You also got garbage chutes in the stairwells, and if the building was 14 stories or higher, it had cargo elevators, a big step up from the basic functionality of Khrushchevkas. So the Brezhnevkas were certainly better than the Khrushchevkas. But if we're talking about the best Soviet housing, the Stalinkas still reign supreme. But here's the thing, by the time Brezhnevkas replaced Khrushchevkas as the dominant housing type, the hierarchy in Soviet housing was clear as day, and it was a reflection of something deeper, class. At the bottom of the chain, you still had about 17% of the population stuck in communal apartments or dormitories. These were mostly manual labourers, low-skill workers, or peasants who had recently migrated to the cities. They weren't living the dream, to say the least. Next up, Khrushchevkas. These were mostly inhabited by low-skill workers, but also had a few professionals thrown into the mix. And even though they were a step up from communal living, by the Brezhnev era, they were starting to feel outdated. Tiny rooms, bad insulation, the works. Then you had the Brezhnevkas, the new standard. These had a mix of high and low skill workers living side by side. These buildings were more comfortable, more practical, still nothing too luxurious. And at the top, Stalinkas. These monumental structures had been around since Stalin's time, but they aged like fine wine. By the 1980s, they were still housing the elite, high-ranking officials, Communist Party members, intellectuals. They may have been older, but they remained the most prestigious places to live. High ceilings, grand facades, and a sense of luxury that the later, mass-produced buildings couldn't match. Brezhnev might not have revolutionized Soviet housing like Khrushchev did, but his era marked a shift from survival to stability. It was a time when the Soviet Union finally had the resources to think about comfort and not just quantity. But even with all the improvements, the Soviet housing system remained a reflection of the country's deep inequalities. Because in the end, no matter how many Brezhnevkas or Khrushchevkas were built, the gap between the elite and the average Soviet citizen was still there, etched into the architecture, one prefabricated panel at a time. Even after the Soviet Union fell and housing became privatized, the same old hierarchy persists. The wealthy are still living in the grand Stalinkas, while the lower income families, they're stuck in aging Khrushchevkas or even communal apartments. But unlike the Soviet days, now it's a choice. Much like having roommates in the West, people are sharing spaces to make rent more affordable. Across Central and Eastern Europe, Khrushchevkas are still standing, long past their intended lifespan. And honestly, it's because of renovations that have kept them going. But in Moscow, they're taking a different approach. In 2017, Moscow's mayor, Sergei Sobyanin, launched the Moscow Urban Renewal Initiative. The goal is to demolish more than 5,000 Khrushchevkas and replace them with modern high-rise buildings, moving over 1.6 million people in the process. And the response has been mixed. On the one hand, many residents are eager for an upgrade, hoping for better living conditions and modern amenities. But on the other hand, you have residents who have lived in these same apartments for decades, sometimes even passing them down from generation to generation. They've made memories here, invested in refurbishments, and don't want to leave a place that has become home. The government is promising that new buildings will offer similar amenities and space in the same neighborhoods, but people are still worried that these new high-rises won't feel like home. And this is where we see the lasting legacy of Soviet housing. It's not just about bricks and concrete panels, it's about identity, community, and memory. From the cramped communal apartments of the early Soviet days, to the prefabricated Khrushchevkas, to the Brezhnev-era high-rises, it's all been about solving a massive housing problem for a massive population. But at its core, Soviet housing was about shaping how people lived, worked, and related to each other in the most fundamental way. As you walk through Moscow today, these buildings remain silent witnesses to the history of a country that tried to transform housing into a tool of social engineering. And while the Soviet Union may be long gone, the question remains, how does architecture shape society today? And what kind of future do we want to build for our homes? Soviet architecture continues to influence Russian cities and, in a way, global urban development. But what about you? Have you ever stopped to think about how your home shapes your daily life or how your city reflects the society around you? The Soviet Union's attempts to balance ideology, function, and people's needs offer lessons for today's world. So next time you look around your neighborhood, ask yourself, what story is it telling? Thank you to everyone watching. This video has taken a lot of time and research to produce, so I'd really appreciate if you could like and subscribe if you enjoy this type of content, because there's plenty more to come.